welcome. I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh. I just looked at the camera here, and I'm very blue. What's with the blue? I don't really understand why it's so blue, but we're going to go with it today. I'm still in the temporary studio, and I apologize for that. As you know, I've got a radon issue in my main studio, which is in the basement, so I've kind of relocated up here to my office, set up a temporary camera, which is not in line with where I have to look. That makes it very, very awkward, so I apologize for that. This is going to be one of the most fascinating discussions that we've ever done. And I've been doing this for 6 years. I've done a lot of things on this program, had a lot of discussions and interviewed some very, very fascinating people. But this particular story that we're going to talk about today actually not only is just fascinating unto itself, but it is a somewhat personal in the sense that my childhood, this whole story, we're going to open up the can of worms here today, relates to something that happened in my hometown. And it's one of those things where you grow up hearing about it. It's very mysterious. Your mom and dad talk about it. In fact, they sometimes threaten you. And I don't mean that in a mean way. I'm going to explain it in a minute. But they threaten you with this story. You're going to, be careful. Be good or Eva Koo is going to get you. Be good or Eva Koo is going to get you. I actually heard that as a child. And I don't blame my mom for saying things like that. I was a bit of a terror at times. But we're going to be talking about the story of Eva Koo today. And you say to yourself, are you making that name up? Is JV making that name up? Eva Koo, it sounds made up. No, it's not made up. And the story is almost unbelievable. It's borderline unbelievable, but it's a true story. And we're going to be bringing a filmmaker in, Lori Kelly Bailey, who made a film about the Eva Koo story. It's called A Roadhouse Koo, Koo spelled C-O-U-P. We're going to bring her in a minute. Before we do that, as most of you know, I took some time off from the program. I needed some mental health months. I took about, 8 months off and was able to, recoup, kind of recharge the batteries, if you will. And it was time well spent. However, since I've been back doing the program again over the last month or so, I have had so many people reach out and welcome me back, say thank you for coming back, missed the program, all those very, very kind emails and comments on social media. And I just want to thank everybody who's taken the time to do that, because it really warms my heart to know that not only was the program missed, but it's being received even better than it was when I took the break. So thank you for taking the time and making the effort to let me know how appreciated the work we do here is, because it is work. We love it. But it's still work. It takes a lot of time to put these programs together, especially after the fact, because when we do it live, it kind of just flows as it is. But then after the fact, we have to edit it up and put it up as a podcast. And I know that thousands of you listen to the podcast version of each episode, many thousands, in fact. And thank you for doing that as well, sharing it with your friends, letting other people know about it. And if you are watching the live version of the show, you know that the podcast can be found on any major podcast platform. It's Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. I don't know. The list is long, and you can find it just about anywhere. So thanks for doing that. One more thing I want to mention before we get to this very intriguing and fascinating conversation. I've got this. Look at this thing. This is the new Paranormal Reality TV coffee mug. Isn't this thing fabulous? I mean, there's nothing in it right now, but this thing is fantastic as my little pudgy hands hold it up here. This is available on our merch site. All you have to do is go to the website, which is paranormalrealitytv.com, and click on the merch tab, and you can get into a link that allow you to get not just the mug, but look at this. Look at this bad boy. Look at this thing. I'm looking at the camera to make sure it's, or looking at the screen to make sure it's centered. But look at this shirt. This is pretty cool, too. These aren't that expensive, and obviously it helps us here support the program, because not only are we doing these interviews on all of these channels, but we're doing the live investigations, and that's really the meat and potatoes of what we're doing here. My partners, Rebecca Foster and Britt Griffith, we're all busy planning the next investigation. It's coming up very soon, by the way. And you're going to be able to see us do another ghost hunt live. It'll be two nights. It'll be a Friday and Saturday. It's just a couple of weeks away. More details on that will be forthcoming. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get into this conversation. We're really honored and pleased to have with us today a filmmaker, Lori Kelly Bailey. Lori, welcome to the program. It's so great to have you here. And I have to say, before we get into talking about the Eva Koo story, I want to know a little bit about you as a filmmaker. You've been involved in film for a while, and then when we get to this Eva Koo story, you're going to be able to tell us even more. But how long have you been making film?
20 years.
And are you
independent films? For
are you?
Years.
I know you live. I think you live in the Oneonta, New York area now, right? Are you a native of Oneonta? Is that where you grew up, or how long have you been here?
I was born in Mineville. My dad moved us here when I was 5. I'm 65 this year. I don't care if you know that. So I've been here the majority of my life.
Okay.
And I'm fascinated with the blue.
I don't know why it's so blue. It's very, very strange. I could take some time and adjust it, but I'm not going to bother.
I like it today.
I'm going to be blue. So when I was growing up, I heard about the Eva Koo story, and I wasn't kidding when my mom would say at times, be good or Eva Koo's going to get you. I mean, it was that much of a story that people who grew up in Oneonta were familiar with. Now, there was a lot of rumors about the Eva Koo story. There were different versions of it, and everybody who heard the story growing up kind of just assumed it was folklore, and it is in a way, but the Eva Koo story is folklore based in a real story of tragedy, of murder, of intrigue, of sex. All of those things make up this Eva Koo story, Lori. When did you first learn about the Eva Koo story?
A couple years before filming was the first time I came across the nice book by Niles Eggleston, which sort of profiled Eva Koo. But then it was about 2 years prior of doing the research up at the courthouse, documents following her trail of craziness here, and then talking to some old timers who, of course, just like you just said, they have their own little twist on the stories of Eva Koo and what she did or did not do here. So
let's tell the story, kind of the Reader's Digest version, if anybody even knows what that means anymore, version of the story. And then we'll get into some detail as we talk about your research and stuff. But what in a nutshell is the Eva Koo story?
Eva Koo came to our area in the 1920s into the 30s at height of prohibition. So it was just a great opportunity for her to use her talents to, entice the men of the area to spend their money on her girls and the, we'll call it bathtub gin that she provided for them. So she had quite a service for during the time of Prohibition, and then we all know what happened when Prohibition ended.
Yeah, so Eva Koo moves, I believe, from Canada, comes down, I think, with her husband at first. Was her maiden name Curly? Am I remembering that correctly? Was it Curly Koo, or was it
Curry? C-U-R-R-Y.
Okay.
So Eva Curry Koo. The research that I did, they split up somewhere in the west part of America, yes, after coming from Canada. And then she came to New York City, from New York City, met Martha Clift, and came to our area.
Okay, so she comes to Oneonta. Now, as someone who grew up in Oneonta, and my parents grew up in Oneonta, Oneonta was a growing railroad town in the early part of the 20th century. It had one of the largest rail yards in the Northeast at the time, actually. None of it exists anymore, but it was there when I was growing up. But in the early 20s, it was growing rapidly. There was a new college being built in Oneonta, the State Teachers College in New York, that was growing. The railroad was growing. It was a bustling little town of about, I don't know what, 12,000 people, I think, at the time, Lori. And Eva Koo moves there. Alcohol is illegal because of Prohibition. She opens up basically a speakeasy and a brothel and actually becomes, I don't know if it's wealthy, if we can say wealthy, but does rather well for herself, right?
I would think wealthy for the times in the research. Then she had several automobiles that she owned, beautiful clothing. Her brothel did very well. She was out and about with all the men of town. So, yes, she was, I would say, wealthy by any account for some time.
So she's wealthy. She's doing well. And then all of a sudden, something changes. And what changes is that alcohol, the Prohibition era, ends. And alcohol is no longer illegal. Anybody can basically serve it in a bar, right? And that affects her financial status. And I don't know I'm not sure exactly the timing because I don't remember the dates, but she starts to recognize that her life of luxury is going to end.
Yes, and so she, with the help of her best friend Martha Cliff, who had helped her through the brothel days, they hatched a plan, if you will, to take insurance policies out on just about everybody. She did on her family, friends, employees especially, and then she hoped to cash those in at some time. She took out quite a few on Harry Wright, who was her handyman, Gimpy, they called him. She had a lot of policies on him. And she was still running illegal alcohol.
So she recognizes that the gravy train may be ending, and she decides she needs to hatch a scheme to subsidize her lifestyle. And while there's actually stuff that occurred, and we'll talk about it as well, prior to this incident that we're that the film focuses on, she takes out a life insurance policy on one of her handymen, one of the people that works for her, who actually was, I don't know if he was handicapped, mentally handicapped, what, but he was, he's kind of a slow. He was also an alcoholic, so he was constantly in a fog of alcohol. But she takes out a policy on this guy, seeing, and I think maybe even more than one, seeing him as an easy mark to be able to hatch this insurance fraud scheme and make some quick money. Tell us what happens next, Lori.
He was under her care, and she befriended his mother for some time until the mom mysteriously died, which is interesting. And then even more mysteriously, the mom's house burns down, and Eva happens to collect on both of those policies and becomes the caretaker permanently of Harry Wright. And yes, he was, by all accounts, a little slow-witted, certainly alcoholic, and had some physical limitations.
So he becomes the caretaker of this individual who sleeps in the basement, I believe, of her roadhouse, right?
Sometimes on the porch.
Sometimes on the porch, wherever he could find a mattress, I suppose. And he, the inheritance he gets from his mother's death, I think, was about $1,800, which Eva very quickly bilks from him, and I don't know how she did it, but she did it, and leaving him basically penniless. And then she decides that she needs more money through this insurance fraud scheme. What does she do to Harry Wright?
In the end, or?
Yeah, let's advance the story, then we can get into some detail as we go along here, yeah.
All right, so she sets up the insurance policies on him with the help of Martha, and they talk several times about how to get rid of Harry so that they can collect, and the first few plans they have didn't work out so well. So they drove, they told him they were going to go collect some flowers from an abandoned farm up on Crumhorn Mountain, and he goes along unwittingly with them. So Eva lures him out to the front of the car to check it as if something's wrong with the tire. Martha's still behind the driver's seat, and she whacks him over the head with a 3-pound mallet. And when he drops down to the ground, Martha runs him over twice.
So she hits him with the mallet. He falls to the ground, obviously. And Martha, her accomplice, runs him over with the car a couple of times. And that's how they kill this man for his insurance money. Then, Lori, they take him a little further away, right? And they dump his body on the side of the road because they want it to look like it was a car, like he was hit by a car.
It
was
run.
Like a hit and run. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so talk about doubly horrible. They wrapped him in a blanket, threw the blanket out, threw him in the ditch, left him, called in the report themselves to say, oh, you know, he's missing. We're so concerned. And, of course, the police officer was quick to identify that something was amiss. And the coroner, Tillipaw, I believe, definitely corroborated and said that there's no way that he was just hit by a car, because he was completely crushed and his head was smashed in. So
I mean, just a fascinating story. But one of the things that makes it interesting, too, for our audience, because frequently we talk about haunted locations and ghost stories and that kind of thing. The place where Eva hits this man over the head with the mallet and they run over him was on a hill, a mountain, if you will, even though it wasn't really a mountain, but it's called Crumhorn Mountain. And there was a house on that hill, which I actually have this picture of this newspaper article. It was called a local haunted house. They considered it haunted back then. I'm not sure why. I don't know if we have any explanation for that. But that makes it intriguing, too, because if it wasn't then, it probably is now, right?
It probably is by now. I think it was originally the Scott Farm, correct me if I'm wrong there, before it became known as, you know, the haunted house. Seeing the Mara's great picture, by the way. Thank you for sharing that. But.
And so when Eva and Martha are actually in the middle of committing this crime, committing this murder, they're interrupted. Who interrupts them?
Oh, by the neighbors?
What happens? Yeah, yeah.
Three neighbors, two ladies, and one of the ladies' husbands come upon them. Now, I'll call them the wrong name because we renamed them, obviously, Mrs. Fink and something else in the movie, and I'll give you the wrong name. But anyway, they came upon them right after Gimpy had gone to the ground. So Eva, it's amazing, I don't want to say the words, that she has to stand in front of his almost dead body and cover him up while still talking to these women and shaming them for coming on the property. It's quite crazy. He wasn't dead even at that time.
Yeah, so
still unconscious under the car.
So they were nearly caught, and it's because that these people stumbled upon Eva and Martha at the scene of this crime that later the police were certain that they had something to do with this. Because even though they did suspect something odd in the beginning, they kind of just dismissed it as the hit and run for a couple days anyway, and then started to recognize there was more going on here. In addition to such a horrific crime, such odd circumstances, when they were investigating this crime, the investigators themselves did some odd things, like exhume the body. How many times do we know?
Three
times. They just kept digging this man up. And the reports are that they dug up the body the first time, took the body to the location where they suspected the crime to have been committed, brought Eva Koo up there and made her manipulate the dead body. What was the point of that? Was that just an effort to scare her into confessing? What was going on?
It was. They hoped that the two ladies, Eva and Martha, would be so horrified by this that they'd get a confession right there. But they moved the body around dead a few times and
yeah.
And they brought, I believe they brought him to court one time, the actual corpse.
They brought the corpse to court?
Yeah.
Now, I want to remind people, this wasn't back in like 1750. This was 1934, 1935. This wasn't, you know, this was not even 100 years ago. I mean, I can't imagine doing that in today's courtroom, bringing a corpse in to illustrate a point, but they did that back then. And in some cases, they did it without warrants, from what I understand. They did things without court orders. They just did it to prove their case. Do you have any suspicion, with all the research that you did, that this was a somehow railroaded case, and maybe there is a possibility of some innocence? Because Eva Koo maintained her innocence right up until the end.
I don't know if she was totally innocent, and I don't think any of us will know. But I think I know where you're going. And can you imagine? I was trying to imagine, in looking over the court case, sitting as a female in the 1930s before an all-male jury, knowing that you had serviced all of those men in your brothel, and that was illegal, and they had the goods on you, and you had that little black book. If I was Eva, I would have known right then. Gives up because there's no way.
That's another great point you bring up. So as she operated this roadhouse, which had prostitution going on and illegal alcohol, in the film, again, the name of the film is A Roadhouse Coup, C-O-U-P. In the film, you present scenes where there a lot of the local dignitaries, whether it's the mayor, the governor, the police chief, other people that are notable within the community visiting this particular roadhouse and enjoying the services there. Is that from research or is that artistic license? Did that really happen that you know of?
She did definitely entertain sometimes at other people's homes, some of the dignitaries. There's a lot of creative license in there because I just thought it'd be fun to pepper all of our who's.
Well, that was one of the things fun for me in watching the film is that I knew just about everybody. I know actually very well almost everybody who was portraying a role in the film. So that was a lot of fun. As Eva Ku was on trial in the film, you present Eva as very defiant, but also not completely dismissing the charges against her. She actually seemed to be admitting a lot of what had happened. And we'll get into the idea that maybe somebody else was involved in a minute. But what was her real attitude? From the research that you did, what was her attitude? Was she compliant? I mean, did she confess?
I don't think that she ever thought for a minute that she wasn't going to go down for this crime. In fact, she actually says you can read it in the court transcripts or the deposition she was giving. She believed that she was going to be convicted for this crime, but that she was going to get nothing more than what Martha ended up with, which would be at the most life in prison. And she thought she would actually be in prison in the same place that Martha went. Out that way.
Well, I guess
Martha turned on her. So
yeah, I guess we should offer the fact that it's not a spoiler at this point, but Eva Ku was electrocuted in the electric chair in New York State at Sing Sing Prison a year after she was convicted of the crime, or almost a year.
It's pretty fast, huh?
It's really quick by today's very quick by today's standard. Am I right? I often remember hearing that either she was the last woman electrocuted in the New York electric chair in New York State.
I believe she was.
Is that true? Yeah, I thought so. But the interesting thing is, in the very beginning of the investigation, and I'm going to put the two women back up here on the screen. Eva is the woman on the left. Martha is on the right in the screen there. Right? Is that do I have that correct?
I love Martha? That picture. Yeah, that's right in the Oneonta precinct.
Wow. So in the very beginning of the investigation, Martha was claiming that Eva drove the car and ran over Harry, and Eva was saying, no, it was Martha that drove the car and ran over Harry. Right. And in fact, in the original statements by both of them, neither one mentioned a mallet at all. They just blamed each other for running over Harry. What did you make of those original statements?
I also wondered about the mallet, too. I mean, it plays to a really good story, and the story grows bigger, as we all know, when you hear the fictitious tales. I should have brought the mallet up here to show you, but I'd have to run downstairs.
Which, when you say the mallet, is it a prop, or is it the real mallet?
It is as close, I'm told, to the real one as you can. I didn't make it. I mean, it was actually brought off an old farm.
Oh, wow.
There.
And it's the one that used in the film?
Yeah, it's that 3-pound nasty mallet.
That is, yeah.
Anyway, back to your question. I digress.
Yeah, so in the original stories, there's no mention of a mallet. They just point fingers at each other. These two ladies are pointing fingers at each other. Now, we have to remember something. Eva Ku at the time was, what, 41, 42 years old, something in that neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And Martha on the right, and you know, we look at these old photos, and people always look far older than they are. She's, what, 24, 25?
I was thinking she was around 30, and I think there was a good 10 or 12 years between their ages.
And they're pointing fingers at each other saying, she drove the car. Martha's original statement, this is what I find very curious. Martha's original statement is that she was walking and leading this Harry Wright to some berries or something they were going to pick.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a little bit ahead of Harry. And while they were walking, Eva basically stepped on the gas and hit him. From behind as he was walking towards these berry bushes, which is a very different story than Eva getting out of the car and hitting him with a mallet. Very, very different.
Extremely. We went with the one of obviously Martha staying behind the wheel and Eva getting out, and it was obviously easier to film it that way.
Yeah.
And there was no proof of which one was telling the truth, and since Eva had been convicted, we had to go with that one.
Right. Do you, again, with all the research you did you start to doubt whether the official story, the actual story that led to her conviction might have some holes in it? I mean, what were your thoughts on that?
The only doubts I had really was in recognizing the fact that the all-male jury had no problem being selected a certain way and convicting her. So, Whether she got a fair shot at a trial, I don't think so, but I'm pretty sure they were going to take her down anyway. She knew too much.
Yeah, and by the way, that trial took place in the Otsego County Courthouse, right? Which is the same courthouse.
During COVID.
It's the same courthouse you filmed in, right? But that was where the actual trial took place. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, we tried to use this, like the jail cell that we have her in is her actual jail cell.
Oh, wow.
And it's very tiny, and they intentionally, I'm told, put her in that cell to make her as uncomfortable as possible. So that's the real jail cell. And where she sat for the hearing is exactly where she sat. It was a very difficult shoot in the courthouse. It was the COVID lockdown. And so there was no food, no use of bathroom. I mean, it was really, all the extras were not allowed to come. So you're supposed to have about, like 50 people in the court, and we have 8.
Well, you did a lot with what you had to work with, given those conditions. I'm impressed by that. That courthouse, by the way, for folks that are watching, is literally a block in the direction of the camera. It's literally a block that way, because I'm in Cooperstown right now. So as you learned about this story, before you did the research and all of that, but you heard about it, what made you decide to make a film about it? What was that decision process?
We had just come off of a great success doing the independent film about Garrow, who was my dad's neighbor growing up, turned out to be a very notorious serial killer, very famous case. So I had just finished that great success and thought, you know what? There's got to be one here in Oneonta, because I'm tired of going to the Adirondacks. And somebody, I think it was Doug Brenner, police chief Brenner at the time, said, well, you ought to check out Eva Koo's story, which I did, and said, that'll work. Same thing, court, and then transition back to her crimes. And I just found her to be fascinating. So that was the reason for doing it here, and did it on a dime.
Well, I'll tell you what, the story is fascinating. We haven't even done it justice, because this is one of those things, as you read about it, the more you learn about it, the more fascinating it becomes. The film does it justice. Our descriptions here, we wouldn't have time to get into it in as much detail as you deserved to hear as an audience. But were you surprised that more attention hasn't been given to this case, given how fascinating it is?
Are fascinated with it now, and the more people I met, obviously you saw the dignitaries and the people in town, it was just like, yes, this is a story that needs to be told. And I am surprised that it's not outside of our area, maybe because there was just a book. I think there was a small film or a play years ago done about this case. But that's it, and it deserves way more than what we were able to give it. I mean, I don't know if a bigger production would have helped or not. I've worked on a couple of big productions, and I'm sure you know that they have their own problems.
I'm just fascinating because, again, hearing about this story all growing up, and with the current state of pop culture in the United States, there is this fascination with true crime in general. I mean, the biggest limited series on Netflix and HBO Max and all of these streaming channels are all these true crime stories. We're going through right now the Murdaugh or whatever story. People are fascinated by this stuff. Yet we have this really intriguing story of a woman, a murderess in a small town. Who basically backs over, runs over a man for the insurance money. She owns a brothel. She owns a speakeasy, all these things. And yet so little attention. I'm so glad you decided to make this film because as I was watching
it. We had fun with it.
Yeah, no, but as I was watching it, I was just thinking, wow, this is such a great story. Thank God someone has decided to tell it.
Well, thank you. I'll have to find another one to do now.
This is a good one. And I don't know how many hidden stories like this there are around the country. Maybe there are a lot of them, and I'm just naive, but it just seems like these types of stories have all been ferreted out, with the exception of this one, which you reinvigorated interest in, which is terrific. Tell me about the filmmaking process itself. I'm sure that I missed the phone call to play a role in that, but that's okay.
You did.
I'm just kidding.
I put it out in the paper. I put a wide net out there.
I'm just teasing. Well,
the first one was the first person I spoke to was I think Mayor Ellen, And she was very helpful, and it turned out to be her family that had done the autopsy on Harry Rice. So anyway, she was very great. How we talked her into playing a tight-lipped prohibitionist, I don't know, but she did it really, really well. And she introduced me to Senator Seward, who also wanted to jump on board. And it just kept going that way. Each person would introduce me to somebody else until we finally got to the DA. That's its own story, as you've probably heard.
The story of John Hale being in the film? No, I don't think I've heard the story of him produced. I was actually surprised to see him in the movie because I didn't think
that's what everyone says. Right? Everybody says, "How'd you get him in that movie?" I said, "I don't know." I asked. They were all just—I don't know. I think they just fell into their characters because they're so used to being in law enforcement and investigations, and as politicians, they were great. And the men, for whatever reason, all the men in this film loved dressing up and going into the Masonic Lodge room where they could pretend to be clients of Eva's.
Okay, I wasn't going to say this, and my partners and I, now my partners and I had wanted, talked about keeping this secret, but I'm going to say it now. The location that you used in the film, the Masonic Hall, which is actually originally was the Fairchild Mansion, is the location that we're going to be doing our next live paranormal investigation.
Oh, wonderful. It's perfect.
It's such a beautiful place with an amazing, amazing history. So when you go to Vimeo, I'm going to put this back up on the screen here. When you go to Vimeo.com/on-demand/A Roadhouse Coup and watch the film, the scene, there's several scenes of this, the interior of this particular building. It's a gorgeous mansion with amazing woodwork. You have some exterior shots of it as well in the film. Mm-hmm. But when you see that, that is the place we are going to be investigating in a few weeks, live.
Oh, during, that is so, election. I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah.
You're all set then for that?
Yeah, and that building was, again, growing up in Oneonta, that's one of those buildings that you drive by, be in the back seat of my parents' car, look in and say, wow, I'd love to live in that someday. What a gorgeous place.
Have you been through the whole place, upstairs, downstairs? Obviously, you've been.
Okay, so it's the Masonic Hall now, and the Masons, my dad was a Mason, and
my son's a Mason.
They had a recruiting meeting that I went to. I ended up not joining, but I went to it there, and they gave a tour of the building. And I was just awestruck by this place. It's such a great place. Yeah. When you decided to use that place, was there a particular reason other than it's just gorgeous?
Well, my son's a Mason, actually a master Mason. He's been through all those, whatever those male things are. So he had taken me in there and said, we should just film here because it's perfect and I can make it happen. So I said, okay, make it happen. We'll film here. It's great.
Forgive me just a second. I'm just responding to our chat room here for a second. In fact, I can do it verbally.
Typing
it out. So, Steph, I know a lot of people have talked about this Fairchild Mansion. No one has ever investigated it. It's never been allowed before. As Lori was saying, her son's a Mason. I have some good friends that are in the Masons. And one of them is, I don't know what the title is, but who's responsible. And he was able to make the decision. Said, yeah, you guys want to do it? We'll open the doors to you. So we're looking forward to a Friday and Saturday night investigation there. All right.
So I'm so happy for you.
When you made the film, what was more important to you? The filmmaking part or telling this story about Eva Koo and what happened?
That's a good question. Honestly, the most important part to me initially was gathering in my community, and this isn't to sound all hokey, real people to film. We had already actually been involved with SAG, and I had a couple of contracts in the works to bring them here. And I know it just struck me one day, I said, this is nuts, because all the attention will go to those two SAG actors. It won't be about our community anymore. It won't be about Eva Koo's story, and it certainly won't be about any of the actors that are here locally. So we just scrapped that, and I went with all real live local people. I said, come on down and try it out.
Well, that makes it a lot.
It was the better thing to do.
And it makes it a lot of fun for somebody who grew up hearing the story, living in the area, and then knowing almost every single person who was on the screen there. I want to play the trailer. I mentioned this actually a little earlier, but let's play the trailer right now so people can see a little bit of what this film's about.
Let me see if I can regurgitate this all back to you. On the day that Gimpy, Mr. Wright, was killed, you say I was able to jump from a slow-moving car. Find a mallet, slip it under my sweater, run back to the car, cracked him over the head, pushed him in front of the wheels of the car to be run over. And drive away. Leaving absolutely no evidence, no footprints, no trail of blood or guts.
Have you reached a verdict?
He's dead, Eva. Stone cold dead.
Again, you can watch the film on Vimeo on demand. It's vimeo.com/A Roadhouse Coup. Obviously, Laurie, a lot of time, attention, and detail went into the costuming. You've got a lot of great old classic antique vehicles. How did you pull all that together? That in itself is an undertaking.
Most people brought what they had for costumes, and then Vicki Hurlburt, who has a store in town here, Shakedown Street, was able to pull also a lot of older pieces and put them together. The vehicles, Wayne Heimer was very good at getting some older vehicles. That was probably one of the hardest things, because we were in bad weather, and for these antique, the guys who have the antique cars, to bring them out, that was tough. We ended up with two, and that's fine. Here's what you got.
You know, it's funny, because every time I watch a film, I think about weird things sometimes. When I watch a film that has a lot of antique vehicles, I care. Oh, I've been watching HBO Max series, Perry Mason, you know, the reboot of the Perry Mason. I don't know if you've seen it. Anyway, there's a lot of antique vehicles in it. And when you watch films like that, the antique vehicles are always perfectly shiny, because you know that the people who own those vehicles, they take care of them like that, and they don't want a speck of dirt on those vehicles. And you know that's not how it really was when they were driving them around back those days, because most of the roads were dirt roads anyway. So
the old truck, if you remember the old truck we had in a couple of scenes, that was great because we could do whatever we wanted to it. But when we had to run over my son who played Gimpy, we had to be a little careful with that car.
That was your son who played Gimpy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
No meeting.
So let's talk a little bit about post-conviction. So Eva Koo is on, she goes on trial. She gets convicted. All the weirdness happens during the trial. As you mentioned, they bring the corpse to the courtroom. They bring, during the investigation, Eva and the corpse up to the murder site, and they make her manipulate the body to try to reenact the crime. All this weird stuff. It's just macabre, weird stuff. Actually, I think we have a picture of the exhumation. One of the exhumations of Harry Wright, right? So, when we talk about these locations, like here's the haunted murder or the haunted house, the scene of the murder, and then here's a picture of Eva Koo's roadhouse, Eva's place, whatever the business. When you filmed, were you able to get to those specific sites? I don't know if any of those buildings still exist or not. I have no idea.
None of the original buildings. We did the best we could to recreate or to go to buildings that looked very similar exterior wise, and then sometimes to recreate inside another building to match it up. Have you been up to his gravesite, to Gimpy's?
You know what's funny? I hadn't, and I actually I had to go out of town this weekend, and when I came back through, I know where it is now. It's in Portlandville, which is about 15 minutes from here. And I'm going to go visit and take some pictures and stuff. Yeah, definitely going to do
that.
Nice. Yeah, yeah.
So creepy up there now, but you can get right to it.
So. Yeah, I imagine it is. So one of the things, we forgot to mention this, one of the things that Eva Koo does in this whole plot of hers, in order to get the maximum payout on the insurance policy on Harry Wright, he needs to be under 50 years old, right?
Yes.
So she does a couple things. She uses a family Bible, which has a birth date in it of 1885 for this man, as opposed to what his real birth date was 1880. And she does something to the headstone, right? What happens there?
She did. Isn't that amazing? I found that out. And when you go up, you'll see the rub off on the bottom. She has a friend of hers go and put her name on the bottom. So it's his dad, Gimpy's dad, mom, Harry Wright, and then she has her name put underneath it.
That's so weird. It almost gives you shivers. In addition to that, in order to keep up the ruse that this man was under 50 years old, she changes has the date changed on the headstone.
Did Martha do it? Yeah.
His birthday.
The headstone. Sorry about yes.
Yeah. So his instead of 1880, which was his actual birth date, she had it changed to 1885 so that he would be under 50 and therefore she'd be able to get him insured. And I think the double indemnity clause, he had to be under 50 if he passed away. Yeah. So she went through great lengths to make this thing happen. But anyway,
what if she just had a regular job?
I know. So post-conviction. And as we mentioned, this all happens rather quickly. She goes on trial. I think in June, was it June of 1934?
Yes, it was.
And then she's convicted. It only takes a few weeks, right?
I think by August she was in Sing Sing, she was dead about 13 months later.
Yeah. So by August, she's in the prison. It's a notorious prison in New York State called Sing Sing. And she's in this prison and she was scheduled to die in October, which would have been just a matter of months from the conviction. I mean, that's that rapid. But the appeal process delays it a little bit, but not by today's standards where it's 20 years later. It delayed it about a year. And then she's executed in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison. What does she say as she sits down in the chair, Lori, to die?
Oh, goodbye, goodbye, darlings. I think it was goodbye, darlings.
Goodbye, darlings, she says.
Yes.
Which are haunting words in themselves. I just can't imagine. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Martha had a famous line, too, and they were parting from each other, and Eva said, well, now I'm going to be famous. I've always wanted to be famous. She actually said that, and Martha responded with, don't worry, Eva, you'll be forgotten soon enough. We put that into the movie because I thought it was so telling.
That's right.
Of the end of their relationship.
Yeah, and here's an announcement in the New York Times, died in the electric chair. It shows Eva Koo there, and I think there's, Mrs. Koo and somebody else are put to death. Calm walks unassisted. It's just so bizarre. This, by the way, is Sing Sing Prison. It's just so creepy. And this is the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison.
And you know that Brenner made our electric chair.
Oh, really? Oh, neat.
Yeah, chief. So he's still the chief of police at the time, and he's building electric chairs. This is a strange man.
So, Eva, in the film, You imply that Eva Koo had entertained, I'll use the word, the governor of the state. And, of course, the governor has the authority in a state to offer clemency or put a stay of execution into a case, which the governor of New York did not do for Eva Koo. Do you know if they really had? Did she know this, the governor of New York at the time? And was that something that maybe was... Again, creative license, or do you think that that was something that actually happened there?
I think it actually happened, but we used creative license because I certainly didn't have any documented proof. And I was going to get called out on that. Where did you actually see this as proof other than hearsay? But he didn't. What I did read for sure is that they called, as they would do, the last half hour, the last few minutes before her execution, and he just wasn't going to let her go. So that tells me something right there.
Right. It's an amazing story. After you released it, what type of reaction did you get from folks? I mean, you've heard my reaction. I'm so excited that you did this, but what else did you hear?
Really? We did really well, and you never know how those seats are going to fill, but we ran it four times here at Foothills and filled every seat every time. So that's very telling. And it wasn't like, oh, here's a free movie. I said that's going to be telling, because if you just give it for free, I'm sorry, people will, I got nothing to do. I'll come watch it. So here you go. Pay the fee. Do you want to see this movie? And they filled every seat every time.
Yeah. I remember when it was being shown. I was out of town somewhere, and I was really, really disappointed.
Sure.
No, I really was. I travel a lot for business, so I was out, and I was disappointed. And I'm so glad that this path led us to here, and we're able to talk about this. And I also have to say this. So I'm watching the movie, and I'm reliving, you know, things that I heard as a child through your lens as you're presenting this story. Mm-hmm. And I really regret not having asked any of my grandparents about that story.
Oh.
Because they were all alive in Oneonta during that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother's parents were Italian. They came here in the 1910s or whatever it was. But they were here. And my father's parents and grandparents were all from here, from the Oneonta area. So they obviously were aware. I don't know if any of them ever spent any time in Eva's Saloon or whatever it was called. You know, they may have. And I never, you know, they're not here now and I can't ask them. But man, I wish I'd asked that question. You know, that would have been so
cool. That would be nice to know.
Do you know
you
anybody?
Could write a book.
Do you know anybody that's still alive that actually experienced her place?
We have one gentleman, and you know what I will do is remind me later to get you the name and text it, because as of at least a few weeks ago, there is a gentleman who's just about to turn 100 who is still alive. And we had corresponded a bit. His family had wanted him to be able to at least sit in the courtroom.
Sure.
He couldn't
because of COVID.
Let me get that information, because could you imagine?
Yeah. Oh,
just... I don't think he could physically make it, but I'll get you his name.
So once again, we're talking about the story of the murderess Eva Koo, a woman who owned a brothel, a speakeasy in upstate New York, Oneonta, New York, where I grew up. And she ended up murdering a handyman that she took care of, really, lived with her for the insurance money. She was convicted of it, and she went to the electric chair. Now, Martha Clift, her accomplice, the younger accomplice, who was her friend, her confidant, what happened to her,
mm-hmm.
Lori?
I believe she served 12 years of her sentence. She was sentenced to 20 and served 12 in Bedford Women's Prison. Got out, and the last I knew, she went back to her family and lived out her life as normal as she could. Harry Navinger also, who was one of the accomplices on the fringe, he went back to the Binghamton area, I believe, and lived out the rest of his life. His family.
I'm glad you brought up that name, Harry Navinger. Harry Navinger, he in the film, it's implied that he had something to do with it, but he was never charged officially.
Correct.
There's some implication that maybe these two ladies could not have lifted that body and could not have moved the body without his help. He, I think, had a romantic relationship with Eva. I heard that somewhere too. But they couldn't get any evidence on him, right? And neither of those two women claimed that he was involved. So he could have gotten away with something there.
Very, very, well, he was a man. They were all getting away with everything.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Right?
That's true. The other thing we should say too is after Eva Koo was executed, she had family in Canada, I think primarily, and the family was contacted and said, do you want to come claim her body for burial or any of that? And they didn't want anything to do with her. Nothing.
No. She's in that pauper's grave, and I've never been able to find out where. Nobody will give up that information. So whether she really was buried in the prison pauper's grave, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anybody that'll...
Yeah.
But hey, if you find out...
I will, for sure. I'd love to know. And in fact, you know, this story has excited me so to learn more about it and to investigate it that I'm hoping in some way we can do one of our paranormal investigations as it relates to this story. I don't know how we're going to do that yet. We're trying to figure out a way that might
be. We should go up to the grave. Up to Harry's grave.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned before the original locations. Where was the roadhouse? Where exactly was that? Do you know?
Well, I've been told that it was out in the Colliersville area. I've not seen any building or scraps of a building left out there, and nobody seems to know for sure. They go, well, I think it was over here, over there. But Colliersville, Portlandville area, couldn't say for sure where.
Yeah, I mean, if you read this article, it says, here on the Albany-Binghamton Road is the little roadhouse where Eva Koo entertained passersby with beer and song. So, if that would be Route 7, New York Route 7, mm-hmm. I just don't know where. I can't identify that. It's too blurry. It's too weird to really know exactly what that is, but I'd love to find that location as well. I've put this up on the screen a couple times. Our time is almost over here, but I put this on the screen. People can go to vimeo.com/aroadhouseco. So vimeo.com/ondemand/aroadhouseco. Watch this film. Support Lori and her work. Is there any other place that they can see it? Is this the only spot at this point?
Right now, that's it. We actually are in touch with the other streaming videos. It used to be so easy. You could just fast track yourself in, but now there's a lot of, you got to closed caption it and all that kind of stuff. So we're doing that. Yes, it will be out on others. And I'd like to speak with Spectrum a little more, too, to see if we can just, even a week of, on demand there would be good. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you can see the film here. That QR code will take you there on the screen. I want to ask you before I let you go about casting. I talked about all the local folks. The lead was played by Alan. What was the?
Roe Kelly.
Alan Roe Kelly. Is that what it is?
Yep.
Is that a Kelly relationship to you, Kelly?
Not at all. No, okay. Spelled the same way and everything, but no relationship. I knew Alan. I met Alan when we did the movie Mineville, 20-some years ago. He was the hair and makeup artist there. And yes, I say he. People are often confused by that. So Alan Roe Kelly, who played Eva Koo, is a he. And he nailed it.
Yeah, I mean, great job. But as I'm watching, I'm curious as why you made that decision. What were you trying to present?
I wasn't at the time trying to present nothing. I had gone through a lot of auditioning here with local. I just couldn't find anyone who had the chops as a female to do that role. And then I remembered Alan. I thought, "Gee, let's have him step up and read and try it out." And he did. He came dressed to the hilt, knew everything about the part, and just did it so well. I said, okay, we're just going to go with it. But no real agenda. Now the way things are today, thank God there probably was one. But
I know. You can see over Lori's right shoulder the movie poster there. And that is a picture. Is that right? That is Alan right there as Eva Koo. Again, you can see that if you catch the film, and I highly recommend watching. It's such a great story, and Lori did such a great job at presenting it. Lori, I don't know if you've got anything else in the works that you want to tell us about, or if you're looking for your next project, or what's happening.
Well, I definitely want to do another one here. Hoping to do it in the fall. It would also be a bit of a crime drama. I'm kind of tired of doing the hacker slasher kind of stuff, but I do have another one in the works, and if all goes well, we do have the funding for it, so we're already as greenlit as you can be, and I would like to try it again here locally.
So you already have a story in mind? Is that what you?
I do.
Is it a true crime story? Can you tell us that?
It is. Well, I wouldn't say true. It is based on truth, crime story. Definitely a crime story of modern day. I'm not going to do another period piece, Lord.
Well, it's funny. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking to myself, okay, so what other really interesting stories are there related to, crime? And the ones that come to mind are like the Linda Velzi. I don't know if that's one that you came across.
Oh, yes. I was around. Yeah, I definitely was around when that happened.
She was a college student that was picked up, hitchhiking, picked up by a guy the name of Ricky Knapp, and ended up.
He was my neighbor.
That was your neighbor?
Ricky Knapp was, and so was Carol.
Wow. That's a little strange, Lori. I don't know if I'd be bragging about that.
Would you like to buy the house next door?
Yeah, right. there's some odd ones. No others are coming to mind at the moment, but I know there are some odd. But anyway, so. Again, thanks for joining us.
You've got some
other things that you've already done. What are some of the other works that, if someone was interested in following some of the things you've done, they should check out?
We did Silent But Deadly with William Sadler and Jason Mewes. He's a handful.
Yeah, I know Jason, actually.
I've had him, you know what I mean.
I do a horror film convention. I had to stop when COVID hit, and I haven't restarted it, but I did for 12 years, called Scaricon, and it was like a Comic-Con.
He's great.
Yeah,
I did that movie with them, and that was great fun. We filmed in Canada. Mineville, which was my first one, that was a labor of love. It's got an all-star cast, but it was the hardest thing I've ever done because it was the first thing. And Geralt, which has been great. What else? I got another one in there somewhere.
I have to be honest. I don't know the Geralt story, but now that you've brought it up, I'm going to have to watch your film and learn about this because that sounds interesting.
Yeah, that one's hard. That one's hardcore.
Wow.
So in that one, we rape and kill my daughter, and in this one, we run over and kill my son.
Jeez, your kids must not be... they must be like, Mom, what are you getting me into here?
Something wrong. Who else can you do it to?
That's true. Well, anyway, Laura,
you can get Garrow online.
Yeah, thanks so much for agreeing to chat with us today. Chat room's loving the discussion. They know where to see the film, and I'm sure many of them will do that. So thank you. Thank you for bringing this story to us. And thank you for joining us today to chat about it.
Thank you. And I'm so happy about the lodge.
Yeah, that's going to be, I'll give you more details on that so you know. Yeah, so you can see what we do. Absolutely. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, Lori Kelly Bailey. And you can go to Vimeo and watch the film. Again, it's vimeo.com/on-demand/A Roadhouse Coup. Thanks again, Lori, for being here. We appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Okay. So, folks, I'm going to just remind you one more time. You can go to our website, paranormalrealitytv.com. We've got a merch tab there. But in addition to that, we've got a place where you can recommend locations. And I'm going to open that up to stories, too. Like the story we just told with Lori Kelly Bailey's help. About Eva Koo. If you know a story like that, go to the website, hit recommend location. You can put that same information about a story versus a location into that form and let us know about it because these things are fascinating. In fact, I was talking to one of our investigators who's going to be joining us for the investigation that I mentioned at the Masonic Lodge, the Fairchild Mansion in Oneonta. And she was saying, you know what? We got to do more true crime stuff. And I said, you know what? I agree because I love the true crime stuff. It's just I don't know if it's a macabre thing. I don't know what it is, but it's just fascinating. And you get into the minds of these people, whether it's victims or the criminals themselves, the people who commit these acts, and you just wonder what's going on. You know, it is fascinating, though. So go to ParanormalRealityTV.com, hit the recommend location. You can also recommend stories that you want us to look into. I don't think I've got anything else to mention. I know Rebecca Foster will be doing some readings tonight on our channels, all of the Twitch channel and I think the YouTube channel as well. If you want to join her, you might get a reading from her, which is always a lot of fun and kind of can be spooky in itself because she does such a great job. She has such great insight into people. And then we've got Britt Griffith, who's going to be doing some tech talk stuff about equipment that we use in our investigation. So there's a lot of stuff coming up. Be sure to follow, subscribe, like, and share our channels because there's so much happening on here and we don't want you to miss any of it. But thanks for joining me today. I appreciate all of that. I appreciate you being patient with this temporary studio setup that I've got here. And again, thank you for all the kind words now that we've reintroduced these interviews and discussions. We will see you all next time. Have a great rest of your day.